This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Long Island and Connecticut, then New York City. I'm Ken Gale, and I'll be speaking with three solar installers and a Sierra Club activist Wednesday morning from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. May 28th here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. That's Wednesday, May 28th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m.
Solar power, inexpensive energy.
If you or someone you know is in foreclosure, listen carefully.
There's a new scam in town targeting homeowners
Why is this out in one ear?
Here's how it works.
Scammers promise to save you from foreclosure.
Come on.
All you have to do.
Am I going to have to go through the whole show like this?
They say you can lease your home from them
and
then buy it back once you're on your financial feet.
Perhaps they offer you some cash.
But after you've signed over your title, the scammer quickly gets a new mortgage on the property and evicts you from your home. You lose the equity and everything you've invested in your home.
New York has a new law outlining foreclosure rescue scams that went into effect on February 1st, 2007. These types of sale-leaseback scams that target people of color, seniors, and women may also violate the Federal Fair Housing Act.
If you believe you have been targeted by these scammers, please call New York City's information line 311
or NEDAP at 212-680-5100.
Sorry about that, folks. I'm having a bad night, as perhaps you have gleaned. Okay, I'm going to start out by complaining about technology. That's not what I intended to start out doing, but I'm going to start out complaining about technology and giving a retroactive FCC alert. If you're offended by dirty language, well, too late. I just blew it. This microphone is not working. This microphone is out in one ear. And usually, if I monkey around with the microphone enough, it will start to work. But tonight, it's not. Tonight, I have no sound in one ear, and that makes it throws me off kilter. I don't like it when that happens. Really puts me out of sorts when I can't hear myself in one ear. I'd like to know why I should have to put up with this. I really would. Well, I'm going to be doing lots more complaining about technology tonight. That's not what I intended to do, but in some ways it's quite appropriate to the theme of the show, which is coming up next. And that show is, well, supposedly it's the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM, where we're having a fun drive. And I want to thank everybody who has pledged thus far this drive, because we really need your money so that we can finally get microphones that work. Is that asking too much? This is a radio station. Is it asking too much to have microphones that work at a radio station? Okay, and as long as we're on the subject, you know, we've now in this high-tech smart building, quote-unquote, that we've moved into here. Nobody can get into the premises unless they're already been put into the computer system beforehand. Because we are a society which is afraid to make a move without going through such rigmarole ever since 9/11. And there was a friend of mine who wanted to join me on the air tonight. And I don't know if she's arrived or not, but I had a lot of trouble getting her into the system. Because, you know, it's absolutely mandatory that, you know, anybody who's entering the premises has got to have their name in the computer system. And then, lo and behold, the computer system doesn't work. And it's full of glitches, and it's impossible to enter the name. Or at least it's impossible to enter the name in a timely manner. So my apologies to my friend Marisol. If you are waiting downstairs trying to get in, actually, I think I see her coming. Okay. Because I was battling the controls for around 15 minutes trying to get the computer system to roll over and say uncle. And it kept on giving me error messages, and then the measures which I took to try to correct the errors were not working, and it was just a typical, you know, techno quagmire. And, you know, God forbid you should explain this, that, oh, you know, the system doesn't work, so maybe you could, like, you know, buck protocol a little bit, just loosen the protocol a little bit, and let somebody in, even though their name isn't in the system. But no, we can't have that. Of course not. Because computers are omnipotent. And, okay, by the way, did anybody out there happen to notice, this really isn't, you know, what we're supposed to be talking about tonight, but as long as I'm on a rant, I didn't want to rant tonight. I really didn't want to rant tonight. I hope this isn't going to be my famous swan song episode, given that I started the show out with a tremendous faux pas, for which I crave your apologies and indulgence. But, you know, Metro cards, I have just discovered, are the biggest scam in the world. I never liked them, but the other day, you know, usually I don't bother to keep track of how much money I actually have on my Metro card, because I just figure that, oh, the system wouldn't rip me off, right? So I don't, you know, take notes every time I, you know, spend $2 on the subway. But the other day, I had just bought a brand new Metro card, so I knew exactly how much I had on it. And then I went to use it, and I got that please swipe again at this turnstile message coming up on the screen. So I did. I followed the instructions, and I swiped again at that turnstile, and it asked me to swipe yet a third time. And when I did, I found that I had been charged for every time that I had swiped, even though I wasn't allowed to go through the turnstile. So while I thought that I would have been spending $2, in fact, I had just spent $6. And the only reason I even knew is because it happened to be a brand new Metro card. So from now on in, I'm going to keep fastidious track of how many rides I use per Metro card. And, of course, you know, the way they've got it configured now, their way of sneaking in a rate hike with thinking we're not going to notice, is that it's impossible to buy a Metro card in a number which is a number of rides which is divisible by 2, in an even number of rides. Or that is, in an even number of money, which comes out to an actual number of rides without any rides left over. So so now, instead of getting 12 rides to $10, I think it was before. Now it's like 11 and a half rides to $10 or something like that, which just makes the math all that much more difficult. And most New Yorkers probably aren't even aware that they're being ripped off every time they get the please swipe again at this turnstile message. Well, I wonder how many millions of dollars the MTA has already ripped us off through this scam. And then they have the chutzpah to not only to sneak in a rate hike, but to do it in such a way that just makes the math more complicated for math-challenged people such as myself. So all this is by way of explaining, first of all, well, I hope I'm not going to get unceremoniously thrown off the air for using dirty language into a live microphone that I didn't realize was on. But actually, it is related to the theme of what we're supposed to be talking about tonight, which is relates very heavily to alienation from technocratic civilization. So it's actually it's somewhat apropos of what we're going to be discussing tonight. And with that, it's now, well, we've already lost 8 minutes with me ranting. I didn't intend to rant tonight, and we're already 8 minutes into the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and all I've been doing is ranting and haven't even got to the subject matter I wanted to get to, and I've got actually quite a daunting amount that I'm trying to squeeze into the show, so we're off to a terrible start. So with no further ado, let me say that it is now time for this. Right? Right? Right. Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there. Well, now I feel a little bit better. This is what I wanted to do tonight. Now, said the badger, if only we could wake the spirits of these trees and this well, we should have done a good day's work. Can't we? Said Caspian. No, said Truffle Hunter. We have no power over them. Since the humans came to this land, felling forests and defiling streams, the dryads and naiads have sunk into a deep sleep. Who knows if ever they will stir again, and that is a great loss to our side. The Telmarines are horribly afraid of the woods, and once the trees moved in anger, our enemies would go mad with fright and be chased out of Narnia as quick as their legs could carry them. What imaginations you animals have, said Trumpkin, the dwarf, who didn't believe in such things. But why stop at trees and waters? Wouldn't it be nicer if the stones started throwing themselves at old Miraz? The badger only grunted at this, and after that there was such a silence that Caspian nearly dropped off to sleep when he thought he heard a faint musical sound from the depth of the woods at his back. Then he thought it was only a dream and turned over again, but as soon as his ear touched the ground, he felt or heard, it was hard to tell which, a faint beating or drumming. He raised his head. The beating noise at once became fainter, but the music returned, clearer this time. It was like flutes. He saw the Truffle Hunter, the badger, was sitting up straight, staring into the wood. The moon was bright. Caspian had been asleep longer than he had thought. Nearer and nearer came the music, a tune wild and yet dreamy, and the noise of many light feet, till at last, out from the wood, into the moonlight, came dancing shapes such as Caspian had been thinking of all his life. They were not much taller than dwarfs, but far slighter and more graceful. Their curly heads had little horns. The upper parts of their bodies gleamed naked in the pale light, but their legs and feet were those of goats. Fawns! Cried Caspian, jumping up, and in a moment they were all round him. Before he knew what he was doing, he found himself joining in the dance. Trumpkin, with heavier and jerkier movements, did likewise, and even Truffle Hunter hopped and lumbered along about as best he could. The fawns footed it all around Caspian to their reedy pipes, their strange faces, which seemed mournful and merry all at once, looked into his. Dozens of fawns, Mentius and Abentinus and Domnus, Valens, Valtinus, Girbius, Niminus, Nausus, and Oscuns. When Caspian awoke the next morning, he could hardly believe that it had not all been a dream, but the grass was covered with little cloven hoof marks.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, as you may have guessed, I saw the Narnia movie this week, and okay, why are the phones ringing in the background? Ostensibly, I'm not supposed to be pitching, so let me figure out how to turn down this phone while we listen to some more of this very strange music. There we go. Well, that music certainly sounds otherworldly, doesn't it? That's my Narnia soundtrack, okay? This is the music that I've been looking for all of my life. And this is the music which I could hear, like the fauns dancing, these faint echoes of from perhaps some genetic memory somewhere off in my mind when I first read The Chronicles of Narnia when I was 12 years old. And lo and behold, I finally found this music. Okay, what have we been listening to? This is the music of the Laz people, who are an ancient people of the Caucasus Mountains. And they've kept their musical tradition with their pipes and their fiddles very, very much alive, in spite of the onslaughts of industrial civilization. This is from an album called Lazaburi, Documentary of Authentic Laz Music, which was produced in Turkey, which is where the Laz are to be found. And a big shout-out to my good buddy and one of the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusades network of agents at large, David Bloom, for bringing this music back from Turkey for me. Now, the Laz are in Turkey because their original home was actually in the Caucasus Mountains in what's now Georgia. But during the period of Ottoman domination, they converted to Islam. So when Georgia was annexed to the Russian Empire in 1801, they were forced to flee south into what is now Turkey. And that's where they are to be found today. Their language and culture is unfortunately, it's dying. Certainly the language appears to be, appears not to be doing well. They think it's not going to last into the next generation because the youth aren't learning it. And most of the music on this album, these are field recordings, of course, were recorded back in the 1970s and some even earlier, much earlier. So, I'm not quite sure how the musical tradition is doing, either, but, there seems to be something of a Laz cultural revival going on as well, despite the fact that they're, you know, meeting with official discrimination because they're not a part of the official Turkish culture, as it were. Now, the interesting historical background to the Laz is that they are held to be by themselves and, in fact, by many archaeologists, the descendants of the ancient kingdom of Colchis. And students of Greek mythology will recall Colchis as being the land of the Golden Fleece, which in the great epic of Jason and the Argonauts, Jason sails across from Thessaly in contemporary Greece, sails across what was then known as the Unfriendly Sea, today the Black Sea, to the Caucasus kingdom of Colchis, and steals the Golden Fleece. And contemporary Laz are held to be the descendants of the kingdom of Colchis. And the story of Jason and the Argonauts is basically it's a story of a prince who is usurped of his crown and forced into exile and likely to his death by his uncle, who has stolen the crown. And this is a story which occurs over and over again. It's the story of Jason and the Argonauts, and it's the story of Hamlet, and it's the story of Prince Caspian by C.S. Lewis. And, of course, in Jason and the Argonauts, Jason actually succeeds in his quest and brings back the Golden Fleece and regains his kingdom, but the methods which he uses to achieve his quest are so morally repugnant and so evil and blood-drenched that he brings misfortune, grave misfortune, down on himself and his family and loved ones, and despite regaining his kingdom, he dies a broken man, because it's a Greek myth. And, of course, in Hamlet, the whole thing turns into an orgy of mass insanity and mutual homicide, and all the main characters wind up killing each other because it's a Shakespearean tragedy. And in Prince Caspian, well, everybody lives happily ever after, except the bad guys. They die. Everybody else lives happily ever after because it's a fairy tale. And, the thing which really appealed to me in Prince Caspian when I first read it when I was 12 years old, and all of the Chronicles of Narnia, was the pagan imagery. That's what really appealed to me. And the first one in the series, which is also the first one that Disney made a movie out of, was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which I think should probably be called The Lion, the Witch, and the Allegory, because it's very, it's clear-cut biblical allegory. And there's three books in the series which are clear-cut biblical allegory. That's one of them. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is the gospel story, straight up. And even when I was, a mere tyke of 12 and very naive, I sort of began to pick that up at a certain point, and I began to realize that I was being propagandized, and I sort of resented it. And The Magician's Nephew is Genesis, and The Last Battle is Revelations. The other books in the series are not quite so biblical, are not quite so allegorical, and less propagandistic. And there's a certain sense that C.S. Lewis actually had more fun with them. And Prince Caspian is the one which is most heavily pagan out of the series, in fact, and consequently is the one which appealed to me the most when I was 12 years old. And you've got this corrupt kingdom of mere mortal human beings who cut down the forests and dam the rivers and build bridges and canals and make themselves the masters of the earth. And all of the original peoples of Narnia, who are the dryads, or the tree spirits, and the naiads, or the river spirits, and the fauns, are forced to flee into exile and flee up into the mountains and take hiding deep, 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 deep in the woods. And the fauns, of course, that's the word which C.S. Lewis used, also known as satyrs. This is basically, the woodland god who was known to the Romans and the Greeks as Pan, and to the Celts as Cernunnos. And probably has roots which are much, much deeper. And certainly, I would say that the ancient Laz, who were a goat-herding people in the mountains of the Caucasus, almost certainly honored the horned, goat-footed woodland god, from whence C.S. Lewis drew the imagery, which so appealed to me when I was 12, and actually appealed to me much, much, much more than all of the rather propagandistic Christian, biblical allegorical stuff which was going on in the books. And Prince Caspian is one of he's the true heir to the throne, and he's also one of the few people in the among the ruling caste in Narnia, the Telmarines, who actually believes or wants to believe all the old stories about the tree spirits and the fauns, and is attracted rather than repelled by those old stories. And when he is forced to flee, of course, when his uncle sends him into exile and under threat of death, He goes deep into the woods, and of course he finds and joins forces with these nature spirits and leads a revolution and destroys the technocratic tyranny. All right, it's not exactly technocratic. I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but it's sort of proto-technocratic tyranny of the of the Telmarines. Now, they haven't actually got to the point of technological civilization yet, but they are cutting down the forest and damming the rivers and all that sort of thing. So it's very clear what they represent and what Prince Caspian represents and what the tree spirits and the dwarfs and the talking beasts and the other mythological creatures who come back and conquer at the end, what they represent. So this is really, it's sort of a revenge fantasy. You know, the Prince Caspian is a revenge fantasy. And boy, am I in the mood for a good revenge fantasy tonight. Oh boy, am I ever. So, here, just to, but by way of here, let me delve a little bit more into the actual text here. This is when he first is forced to flee, and he's riding alone with his horse into the wilderness. Prince Caspian was now in a land of hills going up and down, but always more up than down. From every ridge, he could see mountains growing ever bigger and blacker ahead. As the evening closed in, he was riding their lower slopes. The wind rose. Soon rain fell in torrents. His horse became uneasy. There was thunder in the air, and now they entered a dark and seemingly endless pine forest. And all the stories Caspian had ever heard of trees being unfriendly to man crowded into his mind. He remembered that he was, after all, a Telmarine, one of the race who cut down trees wherever they could and were at war with all wild things. And though he himself might be unlike other Telmarines, the trees could not be expected to know this. Well, you know, I've always felt that I was unlike other people of American civilization. And in the book, most of the people who in fact join with the woodland spirits in the rebellion against the Telmarines, they've got a little bit of the blood of the old Narnians in them themselves. They have dwarfish blood somewhere deep in their ancestry. And so they've got this sort of atavistic impulse. Now, Caspian doesn't, okay? Caspian is a pure-blooded human being, but he also shares in the atavistic impulse. And, you know, I've often wondered, and I certainly felt this way when I was 12 years old, when I first read the books, if I wasn't just, you know, a little bit different from everybody else, which is why, you know, I have such troubles with technology and computers and metro cards and microphones. Well, by the end of the book, Caspian has become the king of old Narnia, and they're fighting new Narnia, that is to say, the dynasty of the Telmarines. And all of the, and of course, the great lion, Aslan, has come back from across the sea to help them all out. And in the first book, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Caspian is pretty much, he's pretty much straightforwardly Christ. He's the Lion of Judah. And so he is especially in the last battle, which is about the apocalypse. But he doesn't really behave like Christ that much in Prince Caspian. He behaves more like a pre-Christian, you know, pagan nature spirit. And in fact, all of the nature spirits, all of the tree spirits for dryads and the water spirits for naiads and the talking beasts and the dwarfs and so on, they all rally around him, and he leads them as they rise up and they tear down the bridges over the rivers, which have been built over the ridges and over the rivers, and tear down the fortresses and the battlements which the Telmarines have erected, and finally enter the Telmarine towns and tear down the prisons and tear down the schools. So what 12-year-old kid wouldn't be able to relate to that? Especially a maladjusted proto-anarchist 12-year-old kid such as I was way back in 1974 or whenever it was. So here, this is from the end of the book now. We just read a passage from the beginning of the book. Now, from the end of the book, where Aslan the Lion is leading all of the nature spirits into one of the towns of the Telmarines. Everyone in the streets fled before their faces. The first house they came to was a school, a girls' school, where a lot of Narnian girls with their hair done very tight and ugly tight collars round their necks and thick, tickly stockings on their legs were having a history lesson. The sort of history that was taught in Narnia under Miraz's rule was duller than the truest history you ever read and less true than the most exciting adventure story. "If you don't attend, Gwendolyn," said the mistress, "and stop looking out the window, I shall have to give you an order, Mark." "But please, Miss Prizzle," began Gwendolyn. "Did you hear what I said, Gwendolyn?" said Miss Prizzle. "But please, Miss Prizzle," said Gwendolyn, "there's a lion." "Take two order marks for talking nonsense," said Miss Prizzle. "And now..." A roar interrupted her. Ivy came curling in at the window of the classroom. The walls became a mass of shimmering green, and leafy branches arched overhead where the ceiling had been. Miss Prizzle found that she was standing on grass in a forest glade. She clutched at her desk to steady herself and found that the desk itself had turned into a rose bush. Wild people, such as she had never even imagined, were crowding round her. Then she saw the lion and screamed and fled, and with her fled all the class, who were mostly dumpy, prim little girls with fat legs. Except for Gwendolyn, of course, sweet little Gwendolyn, who's got that atavistic streak and is not afraid of the lion and the tree spirits, but wants to join with them. And though so she does, she joins the revolution. Go, Gwendolyn. Go, girl. Yeah. So, okay, it's 12:33 in the morning. This is listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. And my name is Bill Weinberg. And this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and we are ranting about C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia. I saw the movie. You know, I have to say that as with the first movie, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's not nearly as bad as I was afraid it was going to be. And especially not merely because it's a movie, but because it's a Disney movie. I was really afraid that they were just going to make a terrible, terrible, terrible job of it. And the fact that they didn't, the fact that they actually did make at least an acceptably good movie both times around, I believe we owe to Douglas Gresham, who is C.S. Lewis's stepson, who has had a certain degree of creative control. But I also have to say that even though, you know, the Narnia movies were pretty good, and so were the Lord of the Rings movies that were pretty good, I still sort of, you know, I still sort of resent them on a certain level, because I acknowledge that I am powerless to resist the lore of the silver screen versions of, you know, my favorite childhood classics, and I had to go see them. But nonetheless, having done so now, I feel that my own, and I only went and reread the book. I reread the book last night. I only, for the first time since I was 12, by the way. I only went and reread the book after seeing the movie, in all those cases, with the last Narnia movie and also with the Lord of the Rings movies before that. I only went back and reread. I read the Narnia books for the first time when I was around 12, read the, Tolkien books for the first time when I was around 14. I only went back and reread them as an adult after the movies came out. So, but they made a huge lasting impression with me. And, one of the things which I sort of resent about the movies is that I now feel that that my own images, which I've been, you know, cherishing all my life since I was 12, from when I read the book the first time, my own images, which came out of my mind and out of C.S. Lewis's words and Tolkien's words, have now been adulterated with images not of my creation, but images of Hollywood's creation, and also of sounds and of Hollywood's creation. And like I started to say at the beginning, my soundtrack to Narnia was music such as that of the Laz, and music such as, you know, a lot of the really deep, ancient, greater European or Eurasian music that we play on this radio show, which is steeped in antiquity and is based on pipes and fiddles That's the kind of music which, you know, even though I hadn't even heard it back when I was 12 years old, that's the kind of music that I heard in my mind's ear, so to speak, when I was reading these books and reading about the fauns dancing in the forest. And, of course, the scene at the end where the tree spirits, the trees come to life, the trees of the forest of Narnia are reanimated once more with the dryads, with the tree spirits, and come to life and attack the battlements of the enemy, of the, oppressive technocratic enemy who, you know, or proto-industrial at least enemy who's chopping down trees and damming rivers. All of that really comes straight out of, the second of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the Two Towers. Exactly the same thing happens at the end. C.S. Lewis uses the word from Greek mythology for the tree spirits, dryads. Tolkien calls them Ents, which I'm not quite sure what the etymology of Ent is, but knowing Tolkien, it probably also has some deep Indo-European roots. But in any event, the concept is the same. The trees come to life, the trees come to the rescue, and they attack the proto-industrial bad guys and win the day. So, and, you know, the Lewis had definitely read Tolkien, and they were friends, and the Tolkien books came first, so, you know, Lewis actually got a lot of his ideas from Tolkien. I don't think he would have denied it, and probably Tolkien only resented it a little bit. But, and, you know, and certainly, as I've said before, the last time I was talking about this, and I promise I'm not going to go overboard. I'm not going to do another show about C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia until the next movie comes out. Promise, okay? But as I said, you know, I said before that, you know, I'm actually beginning to rethink it. You know, what I said before was that the Lord of the Rings can be read and appreciated as an adult, and the Narnia books really couldn't. They were strictly for kids. But, you know, I have to say now that part of what made me say that is in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there is all, once again, this Christian propagandistic stuff going on, and they're kind of beating you over the head with the Christian allegory, the biblical allegory. And Santa Claus makes a cameo, which is really hokey. But I have to say, Prince Caspian, really, it sort of works for me as an adult. Not as well as The Lord of the Rings, but better than The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But once again, the music, which was my soundtrack, I found as an adult. Why don't we hear some more of it before we continue with this rant? Why don't we go back to the pipes? Because the pipes are what really make me feel like I'm going to get up and dance with the fauns in the forest. And then we'll have some more to say. You know, I'm off to such a late start here that I don't know if I'm going to get through all the reading that I wanted to get through. But what I really wanted to do was to take phone calls for the last at least 15 or 20 minutes and see if there's anybody else out there who's a real C.S. Lewis freak and see what they have to say about, you know, how do they feel as an adult about C.S. Lewis? Because I have to say, all right, I'm going to save this rant for when we come out of the music. Let's hear some more of the Laws, and then then I'll continue with my C.S. Lewis rant. Okay, let's see how the Laws are doing. Where are you guys? Oh boy, this is pretty rustic stuff. Okay, let's hear some more of the Laws pipes. Let's hear cut four, shall we? Yeah. Boy, that's music out of the ancient past. Let's see, when was that cut recorded? That was cut 4. Just out of curiosity, that cut was recorded in, do they give the year? You know, unfortunately, the liner notes are in Turkish. But here, 1987. All right, 1987, that's pretty good. I'm glad somebody was still playing music like that in 1987. Does my heart good. Well, you know, my fear is that the music which I'm playing tonight is entirely too rustic and esoteric for most of our listeners. But maybe there's one or two people out there who appreciate it. And, you know, after all, it is my radio show. And I started it out with an egregious FCC violation, so it's probably going to be my last radio show. So I'm going to do what I want. And if there's only one or two people out there who appreciate it, then this radio show is for you one or two people out there who have also got the atavistic impulse. All right. Now, what I was going to say is that, you know, even though I almost consider it, you know, a fortuitous accident in some ways that I was so taken with the Chronicles of Narnia when I was 12 years old, because it led me to, as an adult, and even really when I was too young to quite understand them, to read some of Lewis's adult, both fiction and nonfiction. I've gotten a lot out of them, actually, much more than I ever really got out of the Chronicles of Narnia, I think, or at least in an intellectual as opposed to a more spiritual or aesthetic sense. And I've sort of got, you know, to a certain extent, it's a guilty pleasure. Even his adult literature and his adult expository writings are a guilty pleasure. Not as guilty as the Chronicles of Narnia, which is really a very guilty pleasure. And I feel faintly ridiculous even talking about it on the radio. But it's still a guilty pleasure, not because it's for kids, you know, because his adult stuff is not for kids, but because he's such a Christian moralist. And, you know, it's required a certain amount of exploring my own psychology to try to figure out why, being the, you know, hard-bitten atheist, rationalist, anarchist that I am, I've had such a lifelong love affair with a writer who's a conservative Christian moralist. And, you know, as should be quite obvious from the passages of Prince Caspian, which I started out reading, there are, paradoxically, areas of intersect. And I'm going to do a little bit of reading. I don't know if we're going to have time for phone calls, given that it's already 10 of the hour. But I'm going to do a little bit of reading from two of Lewis's adult works. The first one is fiction. And it's the last book in what Lewis called the Space Trilogy, which the publishing industry has redubbed the Cosmic Trilogy, and probably more accurately, because Space Trilogy sort of makes you think that it's science fiction, and it's really not science fiction. It's more religious fiction than science fiction, although there is space travel. The last one is set entirely on Earth, and it is entitled That Hideous Strength. And before I read a little bit of it, just to catch my breath, let's hear a little bit more from the Laws. Here, why don't we hear cut one? Let's hear some more of the Pan Pipes. Yeah. Anybody out there speak Laz? Can tell us what they're talking about? Anybody out there speak Laz? Tell us what they're talking about. That's a bit of a long shot. But in New York City, you never know, right? Because, I mean, unfortunately, not even too many of the Laz still speak Laz. But in New York City, you never know. There might be somebody out there who speaks Laz. If you do, give us a call. We're going to see if we have time to take a few listener phone calls, although the way things are going, I doubt we're going to get to it. But the number, just in case anybody speaks Laz, is 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900. Okay. In the Cosmic Trilogy, or the Space Trilogy, as C.S. Lewis called it, in the first two books, the hero, who is a philologist based on Tolkien, the main character was actually based on his good friend J.R.R. Tolkien, he gets abducted to Mars, and that begins his space travels, where he finds that the planets are inhabited by angels. And the angels are essentially associated with the Indo-European gods with whom the planets are associated. So there's an angel which is roughly corresponds to the god Mars up on Mars. and an angel, which roughly corresponds to the god Venus, up on Venus. And then Earth is the silent planet, because Earth does not communicate with the other angels because it's in the clutches of, who do you think? The devil. Yes, precisely. So finally, in the last book, that hideous strength, which is set entirely, it's the one where there is no space travel, is set entirely on Earth, and by far the most interesting of the three, by the way. There's a conspiracy by people who are in league with the devil to finally snuff out all traces of freedom on Earth and establish complete diabolical control of the planet. And they are, of course, in the guise of technocrats, real serious technocrats. And the thing is that in the Narnia books, as in the Lord of the Rings, all of the bad guys are, they really look like bad guys. They're really, really evil. They're ugly, and they've got, warts, and they're really just hideous to look at. Whereas in that hideous strength, which is a lot of good social satire going on, they play the whole game, and the whole public relations game. There's a lot of really great satire of propaganda and public relations in this book, worthy of Orwell. And the group which is seizing control of the public education system and municipal governments and so on in Great Britain is the National Institute for Controlled Experiments, the NICE, which is in league with the devil. And the main character of the series, the philologist who has established contact with the planetary angels, is now the leader of what can only be called an armed Christian cult. Sort of like a Waco type organization, except they're all these, these nice, very genteel Anglican Christian extremists. And they're the ones who have taken it upon themselves to oppose this diabolical scheme. And they're led by the protagonist, and he is now calling himself the Pendragon. And the idea is that he's, of course, the heir to King Arthur. And there's been this underground throughout the centuries, this secret society known as Logres, which is the keeping alive in kernel the legacy of Arthur's kingdom and the Round Table. And there's always been a Pendragon somewhere in England who's been in touch with the planetary angels, and now it's him. So chapter by chapter. Half of the book is what's happening with the good guys, and half of the book is what's happening with the bad guys around the NICE, the NICE, and they're both racing to get to Merlin, who has come back to life, and he's got the magical powers by which they can channel these greater spiritual forces who they're in touch with. So if the good guys get the Merlin first, they'll be able to call down the angels. And if the bad guys get to Merlin first, they'll be able to call down the devils. And so, of course, the good guys get the Merlin first and save the day. And the chapters, the two passages which I'm going to read are very telling, because the first passage is going to be with the bad guys, with the NICE, the National Institute for Controlled Experiments, and you'll see that they speak in these very, very sterile, cold, evil, technocratic terms, in rhetoric which is worthy of Orwell. And whereas the Pendragon crowd, the Logres crowd, the good guys speak in this sort of high, romantic, medieval kind of prose, which is worthy of Tolkien. So this book is really where Tolkien and Orwell meet. It's really quite an amazing book. And the passages which I'm going to read are sort of parallel passages, because in the first passage, Mark Studdock, who is sort of the anti-hero of the book. He's a new recruit to the NICE, who's just being, you know, brought over to the dark side of the force. He's being clued in by the director of the NICE, a man named Frost, about what's really going on, that they're really in touch with devils. And then I'm going to read the corresponding passage where the good guys, the Pendragon crowd, have got Merlin. They've reawakened Merlin the magician from the ancient Arthurian past, and they're explaining to him that they are in touch with angels, and they're going to have to call down angels. So they're actually parallel passages, but they're stylistically utterly opposed. So to begin with the bad guys, first let me give a station break. It's 2 minutes of midnight. Here on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. We are being unabashedly geekish tonight and indulging C.S. Lewis. My name is Bill Weinberg, if I haven't mentioned that yet. Anne-Marie Hendrickson, our once-and-future co-host, will undoubtedly return to us like the Pendragon one day, but not tonight. And a shout-out to my good friend Mary Soul, who you might hear laughing in the background there. Okay, here we are in the inner chambers of the National Institute for Controlled Experiments, where Frost says to Mark, "And now, please attend carefully. You have probably not heard of macrobes." "Microbes?" said Mark in bewilderment. "But of course." "I did not say microbes, I said macrobes. The formation of the word explains itself. Below the level of animal life, we have long known that there are microscopic organisms. Their actual results on human life, in respect of health and disease, have, of course, made up a large part of history. The secret cause was not known till we invented the microscope. I have now to inform you that there are similar organisms above the level of animal life. When I say above, I am not speaking biologically. The structure of the macrobe, so far as we know it, is of extreme simplicity. When I say that it is above the animal level, I mean that it is more permanent, disposes of more energy, and has greater intelligence. "More intelligent than the highest anthropoids?" said Mark. "It must be pretty nearly human, then." "You have misunderstood me. When I say it transcended the animals, I was, of course, including the most efficient animal, man. The macrobe is more intelligent than man." Frowningly, Mark studied this theory. "But how is it, in that case, that we have had no communication with them?" "It is not certain that we have not. But in primitive times, it was spasmodic and was opposed by numerous prejudices. Moreover, the intellectual development of man had not reached the level at which the intercourse of our species with theirs could offer any attraction to the macrobe. But though there has been little intercourse, there has been profound influence. Their effect on human history has been far greater than that of the microbes, though, of course, equally unrecognized. In the light of what we now know, all history will have to be rewritten. The real causes of all the principal events are quite unknown to historians. That, indeed, is why history has not yet succeeded in becoming a science. The circle to which you may be admitted is the organ of that cooperation between the two species, which has already created a new situation for humanity. The change, you will see, is far greater than that which turned the sub-man into the man. It is more comparable to the first appearance of organic life." "These organisms, then," said Mark, "are friendly to humanity?" "If you reflect for a moment," said Frost, "you will see that your question has no meaning, except on the level of the crudest popular thought. Friendship is a chemical phenomenon, so is hatred. Both of them presuppose organisms of our own type. The first step towards intercourse with the macrobes is the realization that one must go outside the whole world of our subjective emotions. It is only as you begin to do so that you discover how much of what you mistook for your thoughts was merely a byproduct of your blood and nervous tissues. Of course, I didn't mean literally friendly in that sense. I meant, were their aims compatible with our own? And what do you mean by our own aims? Well, I suppose the scientific reconstruction of the human race in the direction of increased efficiency, the elimination of war and poverty and other forms of waste, a fuller exploitation of nature, the preservation and extension of our species, in fact. I do not think this pseudo-scientific language really modifies the essentially subjective and instinctive basis of the ethics you are describing. I will return to the matter at a later stage. For the moment, I would merely remark that your view of war and your reference to the preservation of the species suggest a profound misconception. They are merely generalizations from affectional feelings. Surely, said Mark, one requires a pretty large population for the full exploitation of nature, if nothing else. And surely war is dysgenic and reduces efficiency. Even if population needs thinning, is not war the worst possible method of thinning it? That idea is a survival from conditions which are rapidly being altered. A few centuries ago, war did not operate in the way you describe. A large agricultural population was essential. And war destroyed types which were then still useful. But every advance in industry and agriculture reduces the number of work people who are required. A large, unintelligent population is now becoming a deadweight. The real importance of scientific war is that scientists will have to be reserved. It was not the great technocrats of Königsberg or Moscow who supplied the casualties at the siege of Stalingrad. It was superstitious Bavarian peasants and low-grade Russian agricultural workers. The effect of modern war is to eliminate retrogressive types while sparing the technocracy and increasing its hold upon public affairs. In the new age, what has hitherto been merely the intellectual nucleus of the race is to become, by gradual stages, the race itself. You are to conceive the species as an animal which has discovered how to simplify nutrition and locomotion to such a point that the old complex organs of the large body which contained them are no longer necessary. That large body is therefore to disappear. Only a tenth part of it will now be needed to support the brain. The individual is to become all head. The human race is to become all technocracy. I see, said Mark. I had thought rather vaguely that the intelligent nucleus would be extended by education. That is pure chimera. The great majority of the human race can be educated only in the sense of being given knowledge. They cannot be trained in the total objectivity of mind which is now necessary. They will always remain animals, looking at the world through the haze of their subjective reactions. Even if they could, the day for a large population has passed. It has served its function by acting as a kind of cocoon for technocratic and objective man. Now the macrobes and the selected humans who can cooperate with them have no further use for it. The last two wars, then, were not disasters in your view? On the contrary, they were simply the beginning of the program, the first two of the 16 major wars which are scheduled to take place in this century. Well, that was written in 1943, when the Second World War was still going on. And, well, there probably have been 16 major wars since then. So I would say C.S. Lewis was probably onto something. Okay. Now, the reference, the historically astute will recognize, to the great technocrats of Königsberg and Moscow, who did not supply the casualties at the siege of Stalingrad, but sent superstitious Bavarian peasants and low-grade agricultural workers into battle for them. Well, Moscow was obvious. Königsberg was where the Nazi war machine's Eastern Front was based. Today, the city of what is Königsberg called today? Kaliningrad in Russia is today Königsberg. It changed hands in the Second World War. So, that's the bad guys. Now let's go over to the good guys, where Merlin has just awakened from the dead, and he is being inducted into his mission by the Pendragon, a man by the name of Ransom, who is the philologist who went to outer space and established contact with the angels. And now, just as Frost was explaining to Mark that they're in touch with devils, now Ransom is explaining to Merlin that they're in touch with angels. And they're speaking in Latin, which is the only language which they would have had in common, because Merlin spoke Old English. He's just let the cat out of the bag that the reason that they've called up Merlin is so that he can be a channel for the angels who will come down and destroy the National Institute for Controlled Experiments the way the Elohim destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. "Sir," said Merlin, "what will come of this? If they put forth their power, they will unmake all of Middle Earth." Lost my place. Hang on a second. Oh, it's not good. I'm wasting precious moments here. "Sir," said Merlin, "what will come of this? If they put forth all their power, they will unmake all of Middle Earth." Here we go. "Do not think," said Ransom, "that for me either it is child's play to meet those who will come down for your empowering. We are in God's hands. It may unmake us both. There is no promise that either you or I will save our lives or our reason. I do not know how we can dare to look upon their faces," meaning the angels, "but I know we cannot dare to look upon God's if we refuse this enterprise." Suddenly the magician smote his hand upon his knee. "May Hercule," he cried, "are we not going too fast? If you are the Pendragon, I am the High Council of Logres, and I will counsel you. If the powers must tear me in pieces to break our enemies, God's will be done. But is it yet come to that? This Saxon king of yours, who sits at Windsor now, is there no help in him?" "He has no power in this matter." "Then is he not weak enough to be overthrown?" "I have no wish to overthrow him. He is the king. He was crowned and anointed by the archbishop. In the order of Logres, I may be Pendragon. But in the order of Britain, I am the king's man." "Is it then his great men, the counts and legates and bishops, who do the evil, and he does not know of it?" "It is, though they are not exactly the sort of great men you have in mind." "And are we not big enough to meet them in plain battle?" "We are four men, some women, and a bear." I should mention that this cult has got a mascot, which is a bear, which escaped from a circus. And all that's sort of hearkening back to the talking beasts in the Narnia books, actually. And in fact, the animals do start to talk before the hideous strength is over. And I should also mention, by the way, that the title, That Hideous Strength, is from a line of verse from Sir David Lindsay, a 15th century Scottish poet, describing the Tower of Babel. "The shadow of that hideous strength, sax mile and more, it is of length." And, the end, the big climax, in when the NICE is destroyed, is very much analogous to the climax of the Tower of Babel story. Actually, all of the evil human beings lose the ability to speak. They start speaking gibberish, and all of the animals who escape from the vivisection laboratories start speaking and can talk. So, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So, where was I? Right, okay. Merlin says, "Are we not big enough to meet them in plain battle?" And Ransom answers, "We are four men, some women, and a bear. I saw the time when Logres was only myself and one man and two boys, and one of those was a churl, yet we conquered. It could not be done now. They have an engine called the press, whereby the people are deceived. We should die without ever even being heard of. But what of the true clerics? Is there no help in them? It cannot be that all your priests and bishops are corrupted. The faith itself is torn in pieces since your day and speaks with a divided voice. Even if it were made whole, the Christians are but a tenth part of the people. There is no help there. Then let us seek help from oversea. Is there no Christian prince in Neustria, or Ireland, or Benwick, who could come in and cleanse Britain if he were called? There is no Christian prince left. These other countries are even as Britain, or else sunk deeper still in the disease. then we must go higher. We must go to him whose office it is to put down tyrants and give life to dying kingdoms. We must call upon the emperor. There is no emperor. No emperor, began Merlin. And then his voice died away. He sat still for some minutes, wrestling with a world which he had never envisaged. Presently he said, A thought comes into my mind, and I do not know whether it is good or evil, but because I am the High Council of Logres, I will not hide it from you. This is a cold age in which I have awaked. If all this west part of the world is apostate, might not it be lawful in our great need to look farther, beyond Christendom? Should we not find some, even among the heathens, who are not wholly corrupt? There were tales in my day of some such, men who knew not the articles of our most holy faith, but who worshipped God as they could, and acknowledged the law of nature. Sir, I believe it would be lawful to seek help even there, beyond Byzantium. It was rumored also that there was knowledge in those days, an eastern circle, and wisdom that came west from Numenor. I know not where, Babylon, Arabia, or Cathay. You said your ships had sailed all round the earth, above and beneath. Ransom shook his head. You do not understand, he said. The poison was brewed in these west lands, but it has spat itself everywhere by now. However far you went, you would find the machines, the crowded cities, the empty thrones, the false writings, the barren beds. Men maddened with false promises and soured with true miseries, worshipping the iron works of their own hands, cut off from earth their mother and from the Father in heaven. You might go so far east that east became west, and you returned to Britain again across the great ocean, but even so you would not have come out anywhere into the light. The shadow of one dark wing is over all Tellus. Is it then the end? Asked Merlin. And this, said Ransom, ignoring the question, is why we have no way left at all save the one I told you. The hideous strength holds all this earth in its fist to squeeze as it wishes. Okay, well, we're evidently not going to have time for phone calls unless I skip the last reading and we skip to phone calls immediately. But this requires a little bit of perhaps historical explanation. All right, for starters, the reference to Middle Earth is once again an homage that Lewis was paying to his friend Tolkien, of course. But Tolkien got the phrase from the ancient Norse, who referred to this world as Midgard, or the Middle Earth, as opposed to Asgard, the abode of the gods, which was above, in the higher branches of the world tree, Yggdrasil. And I think that might have also been the Old English word for the earth as well. So that might actually make historical sense. Then the second reference to to Tolkien was, of course, in the reference to Numenor, which of course only is that's purely out of Tolkien. That's got that's entirely a Tolkien creation, which was his version of Atlantis. In as much as he got the idea from Atlantis, I guess it's not wholly a Tolkien creation, but the word is wholly a Tolkien creation. And that was this superior civilization which disappeared into the sea. So in Lewis's world, they might have passed on some of their knowledge to some secret circles, which might still be alive, Merlin says. Okay, then the reference to Merlin says that he once saw a time when Logres was only myself and one man and two boys, and one of those was a churl. Well, that's, of course, astute readers will immediately recognize that's the time when Merlin was the a sort of an uncle figure to Arthur when he didn't know that he was king when he was a young boy, being raised by Sir Kay, his stepfather, and his older brother, I'm sorry, Sir Kay, his stepbrother, and his stepfather, Sir Ector. And yet they conquered. So, and of course, Sir Kay is the churl, because Sir Kay was sort of a selfish and brutish type in the Arthurian romances. and tries to actually steal the throne and the sword Excalibur for himself before he's called out on it by Merlin. Okay, then there's the references to Neustria and Ireland and Benwick. Well, we all know what Ireland is. Neustria was the kernel of the Frankish Empire, which eventually became the Holy Roman Empire of Charlemagne, the initial kingdom established by the Carolingian dynasty. And Benwick was a possibly mythical kingdom which appears in the Arthurian romances, believed to be in Brittany, in what's now France. So both Neustria and Benwick are in contemporary France. So that's actually kind of a dig at the French, where they say that these other countries are even as Britain, or else sunk deeper still in the disease. And, of course, the reference to the emperor is the Byzantine emperor. Okay, well, you know, I was going to read a little bit more. Now I don't know what to do, whether I should read more or take listener phone calls. Nobody's calling in, so probably I think I'm going to read more. Unless there's anybody out there who speaks Laz who wants to give us a call at 212-209-2900, or somebody who also has a paradoxical love affair with C.S. Lewis who wants to ruminate on this, 212-209-2900. But if you don't want to talk about that, then I'm not interested in talking to you tonight. So please don't call in if you want to talk to me about 9/11 conspiracy theory. Not interested tonight. There's one more thing I wanted to read, although I really don't have time, which is that finally here we are moving from the more juvenile to the more adult stuff which Lewis wrote. The book which was really his, the closest thing that he ever wrote to a political manifesto was the book which he said was he was trying to make the same points in expository form that he was trying to make in literary form or in fictional form in That Hideous Strength. And that book is called The Abolition of Man. And here he really sort of explains, yes, of course, it's sexist nomenclature, but he was writing this book in, let's see, what year? 1947, where he really begins to explain his actual philosophy of the modern world and his actual analysis of what's wrong with technocratic civilization, as opposed to merely falling back on, you know, nostalgia for medieval times and even earlier for ancient times and for tree spirits and naiads and dryads. So let's see how much of this we can get through in the remaining 10 minutes. Man's conquest of nature is an expression often used to describe the progress of applied science. But in what sense is man the possessor of increasing power over nature? Let us consider three typical examples: the airplane, the wireless, and the contraceptive. In a civilized community in peacetime, anyone who can pay for them may use these things, but it cannot strictly be said that when he does so, he is exercising his own power or individual power over nature. If I pay you to carry me, I am not therefore myself a strong man. Any or all of the three things I have mentioned can be withheld from some men by other men, by those who sell, or those who allow the sale, or those who own the sources of production, or those who make the goods. What we call man's power is in reality a power possessed by some men which they may or may not allow other men to profit by. Again, as regards the powers manifested in the airplane and the wireless, man is as much the patient or subject as the possessor, since he is both the target for bombs and for propaganda. And as regards contraceptives, there is a paradoxical negative sense in which all possible future generations are the patients or subjects of a power wielded by those already alive. By contraception, simply, they are denied existence. By contraception, used as a means of selective breeding, they are, without their concurring voice, being made to be what one generation, for its own reasons, may choose to prefer. From this point of view, what we call man's power over nature turns out to be a power exercised by some men over other men, with nature as its instrument. Okay, and you got to remember, he's writing here, actually, what year did we say? 1947. So this is immediately after the Second World War. There's all sorts of oblique references and not-so-oblique references to fascism. and the whole, you know, we will create the perfect race program of Hitler. It actually anticipates, you know, I mean, what we don't want to throw, obviously, I am not opposed to contraception. I'm absolutely 100% for contraception. But all that eugenic stuff, which was going on in the 1930s, was definitely very, very creepy. And the very, very worst of it, the genetic engineering biotechnology industry today is attempting to resurrect, and in fact is resurrecting, in far more frightening and far more efficient form. So, you know, the nightmares of the fascist era, I would argue, are merely coming back to haunt us once again in different names. And it's being sold to us now not as, you know, fascism, but as you know, freedom of choice I should get back to reading here because I'm rambling. But the freedom of choice and capitalism, okay, straight to the point, capitalism. Because but this gets right back to what Lewis is arguing here, is that the problem with fascism is actually endemic to technocratic civilization itself. And that fascism is only the most blatant manifestation of what is actually a much, much deeper problem. Okay, it is, of course, a commonplace to complain that men have hitherto used badly and against their fellows the powers that science has given them, but that is not the point I am trying to make. I am not speaking of particular corruptions and abuses which an increase of moral virtue would cure. I am considering what the thing called man's power over nature must always and essentially be. No doubt the picture could be modified by public ownership of raw materials and factories and public control of scientific research, but unless we have a world state, this will still mean the power of one nation over another. And even within the world state or the nation, it will mean, in principle, the power of majorities over minorities and, in the concrete, of a government over the people. And all long-term exercises of power, especially in breeding, must mean the power of earlier generations over later ones. The latter point is not always sufficiently emphasized because those who write on social matters have not yet learned to imitate the physicist by always including time among the dimensions. In order to understand fully what man's power over nature, and therefore the power of some men over other men, really means, we must picture the race extended in time from the date of its emergence to that of its extinction. Each generation exercises power over its successors, and each, insofar as it modifies the environment bequeathed to it and rebels against tradition, resists and limits the power of its predecessors. This modifies the picture which is sometimes painted of a progressive emancipation from tradition and a progressive control of natural processes, resulting in a continual increase in human power. In reality, of course, in any one age, if any one age really attains, by eugenics and scientific education, the power to make its descendants what it pleases, all men who live after it are the patients of that power, or the subjects of that power. They are weaker, not stronger. For though we may have put wonderful machines in their hands, we have preordained how they are to use them. And if, as is almost certain, the age which had thus attained maximum power over posterity were also the age most emancipated from tradition, it would be engaged in reducing the power of its predecessors almost as drastically as that of its successors. And we must also remember that quite apart from this, the later a generation comes, the nearer it comes to that date at which the species becomes extinct, the less power it will have in the forward direction because its subjects will be so few. There is therefore no question of a power vested in the race as a whole steadily growing as long as the race survives. The last men, far from being the heirs of power, will be of all men most subject to the dead hand of the great planners and conditioners and will themselves exercise least power upon the future. The real picture is that of one dominant age, which resists all previous ages most successfully and dominates all subsequent ages most irresistibly and is thus the real master of the human species. But even within this master generation, itself an infinitesimal minority of the people, the power will be exercised by a minority smaller still. Man's conquest of nature, if the dreams of some scientific planners are realized, means the rule of a few hundreds of men over billions and billions of men. There is neither, nor can there ever be, any simple increase of power on man's side. Each new power won by man is also a power over man as well. Each advance leaves him weaker as well as stronger. In every victory, besides being the general who triumphs, he is also the prisoner who follows in the triumphal car. The power of man to make himself what he pleases means the power of some men to make other men what they please. In all ages, no doubt, nurture and instruction have in some sense attempted to exercise this power, but the situation to which we must look forward will be novel in two respects. In the first place, the power will be enormously increased. Hitherto, the plans of educationalists have achieved very little of what they attempted, and indeed, when we read them, how Plato would have every infant a bastard nursed in a bureau, quote-unquote, we may well thank the beneficent obstinacy of real mothers, real nurses, and above all, real children for preserving the human race in such sanity as it still possesses. But the man-molders of the new age will be armed with the powers of an omnicompetent state and an irresistible scientific technique. We shall get at last a race of conditioners who can really cut out all posterity in what shape they please. The second difference is even more important. In the older systems, both the kind of man the teachers wished to produce and their motives for producing him were prescribed by the Tao. And by the Tao, he uses the word not in the sense that the Taoists do. He uses the word a little bit incorrectly. But he means the accumulated wisdom of human tradition, more or less, which he fears that the great technocratic planners, capitalist, communist, and fascist alike, are cutting themselves off with. And here he says they are reducing everything to nature. When they talk about the conquest of nature, they actually reduce everything to nature because they reduce everything to an object which can be manipulated. And these objects resist they resist the movement of the mind whereby we thrust them into the world of mere nature, as when we are going to be dissecting an animal in a laboratory and it disgusts us. But in other instances, too, a similar price is exacted for our analytical knowledge and manipulative power, even if we have ceased to count it. We do not look at trees either as dryads or as beautiful objects when we cut them into beams. The first man who did so may have felt the price keenly, and the bleeding trees in Virgil may be far-off echoes of that primeval sense of impiety. The stars lose their divinity as astronomy develops, and the dying god has no place in chemical agriculture. To many, no doubt, this process is simply the gradual discovery that the real world is different from what we expected, and the old opposition to Galileo is simply obscurantism.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.